Hey there, welcome to a new episode of the Liberators Network podcast, episode 63 to be precise. My name is Christian Verwijs, and in today's episode we're going to talk about what makes a successful developer culture. Now this is a topic that's very dear to my heart, so I'm eager to get into it, but I do want to take a moment to talk about some of the things that are happening at the Liberators. The first of which is that we're currently releasing our book, The Zombie Scrum Survival Guide, and we're being invited to other podcasts, meetups, conferences. It's taken quite a lot of time, and that's pretty cool because we're very proud of our book, and we're happy to spread the word that it's available now and that you can order it from any bookstore or directly from us at zombiescrum.org. A consequence of this, however, and you may have noticed that already, is that we didn't find the time in the past 2 weeks to record a new podcast, so apologies for that. We hope to do better from now on again, and we aim always to release a new episode every week. Something else that Barry and I have been working on really hard the past few weeks is to revamp our Zombie Scrum survey that you can find at survey.zombiescrum.org into a platform that Scrum teams all over the world can use to support their continuous improvement loop. And that's taken quite a lot of work. It's really cool to work on, and we're very hopeful and eager to get feedback from Scrum teams and see how they're using it to empirically validate if their improvements are actually working out, which is also part of empiricism, right? So these are just two of the things that we're currently spending a lot of time on. And because some of that work, especially on the Zombie Scrum survey, is very much focused on software development, I wanted to take today's episode to talk a bit more about what makes a good developer culture. I think I've been fortunate to be part of such cultures, such organizations and Scrum teams where a real developer culture existed. And I want to talk a bit more about what makes that possible so it can benefit you too, and also to learn from your experiences. The inspiration for today's episode originated in an appreciative interview that I did a while ago with three other Scrum Masters. Of those of you that are familiar with this liberating structure, in appreciative interviews, you share a success story with someone else and they then retell the success story to another pair of people, in this case Scrum Masters. Now the topic for this particular appreciative interview was to share a success story of a development team that you'd worked with in the past, and I participated in that as well. Now just to clarify one thing that may bother you throughout this episode, I will be using the term development team, even though the new Scrum Guide dropped that term and now simply talks about developers. But in this episode, I want to emphasize that we're specifically talking about the people in the Scrum team that are developing the product. Now, I could have just used developers everywhere, but it sometimes feels very awkward, so I will talk about development team. But I do not intend the development team as another team within the Scrum team. It's just the people within the Scrum team that are developing the product. Now, back to the appreciative interviews. What was nice about this was that after I shared my story with another Scrum Master and he shared his story with me, we reflected a little bit on our stories together. And for him, it was quite surprising and inspiring to hear my story because his experience with development teams, with developers, was not as inspiring to him. He had a lot of struggles with it. He felt that he'd never really worked with development teams that were eager to create high-quality products, whereas he felt that my story was reflective of that a lot more. So we reflected on that together, and from that came a conversation about what actually made that success possible. And that's the inspiration for this episode. And I also want to make clear up front that even though this may seem like a success story, there were a lot of things that were not perfect at all. We made a lot of mistakes. We had a lot of conflicts. There were a lot of things that didn't work well. But overall, I think we did a really good job. And there may be something you can take from our learnings in this regard as well. Now, another thing that I find interesting is that we did that appreciative interview together with a large group of Scrum Masters, and the consensus was that most Scrum Masters had not experienced development teams that were super successful. In many development teams, people struggled, there was a lot of resistance, people were not really aware of developmental practices and techniques that could make their development work more agile. So it was apparently, the success stories were quite rare, to be honest. And that made me wonder, what does that actually say about Scrum teams out there? So why is there such a strong emphasis on the people that are needed for the process, and so little on the people that are actually doing the developmental work? Ironically, agile software development was started by developers. And these days, it really seems to be more about Scrum Masters, Agile coaches, product owners, and other, quote, process people, unquote. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. Process people, as I call them in this case, are very important. Just look at the number of people showcasing their Scrum Master, product owner, or coaching certificates on LinkedIn. Most companies are eager to send people to classes for Scrum Masters and product owners. But they're not willing to pay for professional development for developers. And we know, because at Deliberators we've also tried to host workshops for developers specifically, but we were just unable to pull in people because organizations feel it's more valuable to send a Scrum Master to a Scrum Master training than a developer to a developer training. Or maybe organizations fail to see how important the quality, tools, and skills of developers really are. This strong focus on the people that are responsible for the process, no matter how important they are too, it sometimes hurts my heart because I sometimes describe myself as a developer first and a Scrum Master second. I've always done software development, and especially these days at Deliberators, I think I'm spending maybe 3/4 of my week developing, writing code and developing software for what we're doing at Deliberators. And again, that emphasizes for me just how important those technical skills, those development skills, the developer hygiene that's so important in Scrum teams, how important those things are and how little attention actually goes to that instead of focusing on Scrum Masters and product owners. So in this episode, I want to share a personal story of an organization where I worked called Now Online, where I think we shaped a strong developer culture. And instead of a dry and theoretical episode, I opted for a more personal approach. So what I did was I went through my archive of pictures that I took while working at Now Online, and I created this episode and the story around those pictures. Before I dive into what I think contributed to a successful developer culture, it may be helpful to set the stage a little bit about what kind of company we're talking about. Now Online started in 2001, and they started with a strong focus on website development. In 2010, however, we started a second location that focused on developing mission-critical human resource-related products for a couple of large customers that we served with websites before. Now, we started out with a single Scrum team, but eventually evolved into three. And I think at its peak, we had about 25 employees. Maybe a bit less, 21, 25, something like that. I worked there as a developer and as a Scrum Master and basically combined the roles for most of the time. And it's good to know that although I talk about Now Online in the past tense, the company still exists. And the branch of the company that's focused on human resource products is now called HR Office, but it's still there. And many of the people that worked there and that I worked with at the time still look back on their time there as a great time for being a developer, but also for the kind of company that it was and the culture that we had there together. So we all look back on our time there as an awesome experience that I think shaped most of us in many different ways. So that's a bit of background about the company. Now let's dive into what I think made the successful developer culture possible there. The first thing that came to mind for me, also while looking back at many of the pictures, is that we had a lot of fun together. We spent a lot of time making personal connections. And this is a pattern that I recognize in many other development teams that I worked with over my years. At Now Online, some of that fun happened during work, with just practical jokes and having a laugh together, while others happened outside of work, during trips, barbecues, and teams activities. I have to say that the owner of the company, a good friend of mine, he spent a lot of time making sure that there was enough time for people to connect personally. So he would organize outings, trips, all these sorts of things, just to connect as people and not just as professional colleagues. I think that that was really important and vital to the success. So one thing we always took care of at Now Online was to create an environment where having fun was possible and encouraged. For example, there was always a video game console nearby, so after lunch people would frequently crash down on couches and bags to play Grand Theft Auto, Unreal Tournament, or other games. and the company invested in an excellent espresso machine and a stocked bar as a centerpiece to the office. So people trained each other in how to make good espressos and cappuccinos, often gathering around the bar to chat about work and other things. Now the fun thing was that this bar was very close to the entrance, so visitors, and often customers and users, would join in the social chat upon arrival. So you have to envision that the development teams were having coffee together with many customers, stakeholders, users, and that made it very easy to connect with each other. And we also made sure to share lunch, so every Friday most of the team would stay around for drinks and snacks at the bar. And again, I want to emphasize here that the founder of the company played a pivotal role of enabling that here and valuing personal connections, empathy, and the social aspects of work. So that's the first thing that comes to mind, making sure that you have fun together. The second thing that we did at Now Online that contributed to a successful developer culture was that we tried to do continuous everything, basically. And it started way back in 2003 when we set up the first continuous integration server. At the time, I think it was still cruise control with some Ant script, some of you may know it. And we actually purchased a green and a red lava lamp that would turn on based on the status of the builds. The fun thing about that was that it was easier to tell if our code was still compiling after a commit. So if a commit would result in a broken build, the red lava light would go on and otherwise the red one would go on. So not much later, we started using Visual Studio's web deploy feature to simply push a new version to staging or production, which already made it a lot easier for us to quickly release something. And the purpose here was always to get feedback about does it work, does it deploy as soon as possible. Now over time, we extended and improved our tooling to continuously integrate, test, and deploy our software. So at some point, we migrated to Team City, then to App Harbor, for a while, but eventually settled on a combination of AppVeyor and Octopus Deploy. So the entire deployment pipeline was set up and maintained by the developers themselves, and included the service behind them. So if we thought we could benefit from another tool, we could just buy it. And I think it's important to emphasize here that the developers also managed the service themselves. So we put a lot of effort into helping people understand how to configure servers. We made sure that there were experts who could help us configure it well and securely. But the reason for this was that we wanted to make sure that if issues emerged, we could resolve them quickly. And a lot of the people working for the company had extensive knowledge with Linux, of other tools, so it was easy to do that together. There was also a strong understanding among developers that automation was a good way to neutralize excuses to not do something that we knew was important, like running tests or deploying to production more frequently. One of our larger products was in fact so complex that deployment was often done late at night on low-use evenings, usually taking between 2 and 3 hours, and that required the development teams to stay up late. Obviously, the release rate was low for this product because it was a pretty big deal to release. It took a lot of work, it was stressful, and it had to be done at night and against some risk because every now and then the team would run into big issues and other developers or myself would jump in to support the team in the deployment. But once we automated this, a new build was released every single sprint, sometimes even multiple times during a sprint. And this was all made possible by continuous integration, by continuous deployment, and automation in general. And this drive to automate and refactor code bases to allow us to release more frequently was always championed by the development teams themselves, not by stakeholders, not by the product owner, not even by the Scrum Master. It was really something that the developers wanted. And finally, I think we had a lot of fun creating additional tools to show what was happening with our products. For example, one of those was an uptime monitor that we developed ourselves just as a sort of experiment to ping and test the various endpoints of all our products every couple of minutes. And another one was a build monitor that showed recent builds and deployments that were going on our deployment pipeline. We also had a live logging console that showed traffic and events on all our servers. Because the floor where all the developers were working was open, we positioned monitors in central spots so that everyone could see and hear what was happening. and most of these tools were created and improved in the evenings or during weekends or on Friday afternoons just by developers who kind of wanted to figure out if they could build something like this. And I think that that was really nice. The third factor of what contributed to a successful developer culture was that we created an environment where you can take risks. As any developer knows, writing code is difficult and risky, especially when you try to refactor dense, convoluted code bases, or when you have to break down a monolith code base into smaller bits, or when you have to automate something or try a new tool. Most of the products that we worked on required complex calculations to determine how much money to invoice or how much money to pay to temp workers. Any mistake, any bug would potentially cause a lot of incorrect payments and incorrect invoices, so it was very important that we made sure that quality was high. Our products also had to conform to regulations set out by law and unions. So it was important for us to have a large battery of automated tests that made it easier for us to refactor and change these calculations without being worried all the time about making mistakes. Now, in the cases where we didn't have those automated tests yet, we would start with high-level calculations first to verify if the output was what we would expect based on the input and the calculations. And several people in our teams were quite adept at creating and verifying these calculations and writing the automated tests for them, in this case with something called SpecFlow. Now, Scrum as a framework also allowed us to take calculated risks. For example, one of our products allowed temp workers to track their hours and send them in for approval and payment. Based on feedback from users, we used one sprint to develop an improved user interface for filling in the hours, and note that this was actually the sprint goal of that sprint. So we offered a new version as an option for users, keeping track of who switched back to the old version and why. The great thing about this was that this allowed us to learn more about how people use the software and what they liked. And this is just an example of A/B testing, and it's very common in successful Scrum teams, but also many development teams and many developers have never tried it. But this is just a simple example of that. And I think that thinking about how to reduce risks in a complex environment actually made it safer for developers to try new things, to learn, to make mistakes. A fourth factor that contributed to a successful developer culture was that we worked hard to make our work transparent. And this is very much inspired by the concept of Stigmergy that we also talk about in our book, The Zombie Scrum Survival Guide, and there's also a blog post that I wrote about it that I'll share in a moment in the show notes. But the core of Stigmergy is that if you want to encourage collaboration between individual agents, in this case developers, it's very helpful to use your environment as sort of an external memory. So we always worked very hard to make our work transparent and as physical as possible. So we had several movable whiteboards, for example, that we carried with us to wherever they were needed. When we worked with customers to refine the product backlog, we just physically pulled the whiteboard into the room, or we just did it on the wall with stickies where we collected all the ideas, grouped it together, and categorized it. And also on the way out, when people were done with their workday, people would often update their happiness for that day on a small whiteboard that we put near the door. It was just a way for us to start a conversation if we noticed that some people were consistently in the unhappy column. Now, I have to admit that we use Jira to track work done during a sprint. I feel a bit self-confident about it because we don't generally recommend Jira anymore. But we sometimes move the product backlogs from Jira to the wall itself where we worked. So I actually always preferred that approach where we had a visual, very transparent way of just surrounding yourself with the product backlog in a way in the sprint backlog and the sprint goal. So writing down something on a sticky and putting it on a wall near you always seemed to leave a stronger trace in your memory of what you wrote down and what the conversation was than when you file an item in Jira. And that brings us to the fifth factor, or developer hygiene. At the peak of my work at Now Online, we had 3 Scrum teams consisting of around 15 developers. So while we also had some other roles in the company, most of the people working there were developers. And with most of our products being mission critical, and the risk of bugs causing severe downtime or financial damage was significant, there was a strong emphasis on writing clean code and applying practices from extreme programming. Although all developers cared about writing good code, some developers emphasized that more strongly, and these developers, I think there were three or four, developed a natural leadership by using a positive and optimistic style where they actually practiced the behavior they were asking others to espouse as well. So, for example, one of the developers frequently invited others to pair up with him to write a feature, and he would swap the keyboard with the other developer, and they would just swap it around, write code, and share a coffee when things started working. Another developer took pride in carefully checking the quality of the code and would offer feedback to others that was usually constructive, but not always, but that's what usually happens with feedback. And yet another happily removed commented code wherever he could find it in the source code, knowing full well that version control would keep track of those blocks anyway. Generally speaking, we all subscribe to the Boy Scout rule, the idea that you have to leave your code, the code you touch, behind in a better state than when you found it. And that doesn't have to mean like you have to rewrite it. Just remove a piece of comments that are not useful anymore. Make the names clearer. Add a unit test if there's no unit test available for this. If you just follow the Boy Scout rule, your code base will start improving progressively and almost on its own. Several things helped create awareness of what constitutes good code, and I've always found that you have to normalize this very early on. So the first thing that we did was spend a lot of time reading books about software craftsmanship together. So we would organize sessions about the book Clean Code by Robert C. Martin, for example, and several developers would prepare a session on one of the chapters from the book, and then they would share what they learned and discuss the chapter together. And we always did this out in the open. So we had one floor where all the developers were working. We would always do the session on that floor. Even if not everyone would join, we would still do it, but in a corner so that it wasn't disruptive to the other developers. But we wanted to normalize that this is something that developers do. They talk about how to create good code, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's part of work. We also did it during work hours. And we also hoped that by making it clearly visible to everyone, it would be easier for people to join. And that happened, because on average, all developers would join. Another thing that helped was that some of us continuously refactored existing pieces of code as we went through implementing new features, and then would happily show it to others to demonstrate how much cleaner the code was. And I think that this was greatly spurred on by our increased understanding of when and how to apply design patterns, as we worked our way through important patterns from the famous but very difficult book from the Gang of Four on design patterns, much like we did with Clean Code. So in our vocabulary as developers, it became easier and easier to use design patterns like singleton, strategy, factory, mediator, facade, builder, etc. At some point, we started working with CQRS as a pattern, and it was just a great way for developers to talk about complex stuff by using basically the name of the strategy to explain what they were doing and what they were thinking about. But most crucially, I think, was that the Scrum teams took care of supporting the products they built. So when we deployed a breaking bug or when the software crashed, our phones would ring. And this would usually be an angry customer or a user who couldn't log in or was running into issues. And this included products that were in active use for 24 hours a day. So we've spent several nights using WhatsApp and telephones to debug breaking issues on production. And although this was really annoying at the time, it incentivized the teams to test thoroughly before deploying and to automate things as much as possible. It also encouraged us to make it as easy as possible to release new versions and to make sure that those versions worked, because we frequently had to deploy a hotfix, and, well, progressively less over time, but we wanted to make it as easy as possible for ourselves. A sixth factor that I identified in my reflections is that we spend a lot of time learning new things together. This was one of the hallmarks, I think, in general of a good developer culture, and one way we did this was by always having two or three interns at the company. And as I said before, our company wasn't that big, about 21, 25 people, so three interns is quite a lot. Although the interns often had to work on special assignments for school, we made sure they were an active part of one of the development teams, and they would help with testing or pair up with different developers. With few exceptions, all interns wanted to and often stayed to work for the company. It was a good source of new members for our teams, and a good way to embed our developer culture in them from the very start. We also made sure to organize weekly tech talks, where one developer or a special guest would cover a specific topic. I frequently brought in guests from companies we worked with or people I'd met at conferences or just in the Agile community. But more often than not, people from Now Online would share a new design pattern, a book, or just show some of the code they'd been working on in their spare time. Or just something that they were working on in the current sprint. And although the focus was mostly on technology, we also covered communication styles, how to give feedback, how to deal with conflict, and how to work effectively with customers. So it was not entirely focused on technology, but we made sure to learn a lot of new things together. And the seventh factor is that we engaged directly with users and customers. I personally very strongly believe that a good developer is someone who takes joy in solving problems for users, in this case with code or software products. And you cannot do this if you never talk to users. So since the very start of Now Online, the founder always made sure to bring developers with him to customers. And this gave a face to the person expressing the needs on the product backlog. It also allowed developers to better understand their context. We continued this approach as the company grew in size, so often developers would participate in sales meetings or travel with the founder or product owner to customer sites. And on several occasions, we visited customer sites with the entire development team. This allowed us to better understand how people used our products in the real world. So we would then split up and pair with actual users and just see and learn from their use of the product. And on the ride back, we would share observations and improvements and use that to inspire new items on the product backlog. On one occasion, for example, we observed how users would often use our software while on the phone. And this meant that they ended up looking at information on their screen from an angle. We had received complaints about the small font size before, but we always discarded that as a nice to have. But when we observed this behavior in real life, and we understood how difficult the angle makes it to read the screen, we fixed it that very evening. Because we had some proof that this was actually an issue for users, and we understood what the issue was. Another example was how we frequently reflected on the quality of our products and services as a whole, with everyone who wanted to participate. And the founder was always open about financial challenges and opportunities, and what was happening strategically with the company and the customers. And that brings me to the final factor that I identified, which is a shared identity and history. As I mentioned before, Now Online was a fairly small company with about 21 to 25 employees. But we always made sure to keep a strong connection to the history and identity of the company. And one example of that is a picture wall of team activities and former employees and memories to keep around. So in the most recent office that the company went into, this wall actually lined the stairs leading up to the developer floor that was on the first level. When new employees or interns started, this always resulted in nice conversations and recollections because many of the pictures were funny or just showed something exotic and people were interested in the story behind it. Over the years, Now Online moved to new offices several times, and each time everyone was involved in moving to the new location, painting and decorating the places needed. This made the office itself a collaborative effort and increased the sense of shared ownership. And we would frequently spend a day together, at least every year, to purposefully clean up the office, throw away old things and freshen up the place. This was really something that we did together. And with that being the final factor, let's move to the conclusion. What we did at Now Online was really cool and it shaped me as a developer and as a human being. I enjoyed my time there tremendously, as I know that others did as well. But it wasn't perfect. We once spent a year building a really cool product that turned out to be a bit of a dud upon release. Although we used something that looked like Scrum from a distance, it wasn't as empirical as it should have been. And if it would have been, we would have known that the stakeholders were not waiting for this product. And the culture was by no means as homogeneous as it might seem. Some developers valued the Boy Scout rule more than others. but on a whole we did honor it most of the times, together. Over the years we also struggled to balance the many products we developed with the small teams that we had. It was quite stressful at times, to be honest. And purely speaking for myself, I've spent many evenings writing code. Not because anyone forced me to, but because I was committed to solving user problems, as I knew the other developers at the company were too, and some of them were also spending their evenings on this. This is also the flip side of a strong developer culture. It can be intoxicating and unhealthy if you don't have the discipline to rein it in, and honestly, this is still something I struggle with. The reason why I left the company had nothing to do with any of that, however. I left after 10 years of building this company with its founder. It was time for me to move on and to create space for myself and for others, so my focus shifted more towards Scrum, Scrum Masters, and liberating structures. But the more development teams and developers I meet, the more I realize how fortunate I am to know what is possible when you have an awesome development team. And I wish this for every developer out there, and it's the beating heart of what makes Scrum work. So if there's anything you take from this episode, it's to start with your developers and make sure that they understand why working empirically is important and how to create a developer culture that fosters this. And that brings me to the end of today's episode. I hope you learned something new about a developer culture and what you can do to make it possible with your Scrum team. If you have success stories too, please let me know. I'm always very interested to hear what your success story is and what you think made it possible. I also want to mention that this episode, as always, was made possible by our patrons. These are the people who support the show and all the other content that we create at The Liberators, most of which is available for free. Matt B. Berardino, Tom Apps, Jonathan Dwyer, G. Wijnke van der Does, Alexander Ursea, Tony Lee, Koen van Vliet, and Fanny N.K. Thank you so much for joining us and supporting the work that we're doing at The Liberators. We're very grateful for your support. If you like our content too, and you want to encourage us to create more of it, you can also join us on patreon.com/liberators. We have a couple of tiers that you can choose from to determine how much support you think we deserve, and based on that you also receive a couple of nice benefits in return, like discounts in our webshop, we give you early updates, free access to a Discord server where a lot of experienced Scrum Masters are helping each other out, as well as extra content that other people don't have access to. So these are some reasons maybe to consider supporting us too and becoming a patron. I'll put the link to Patreon in the show notes. Having said all that, I want to thank you for listening, for taking the time out of what is probably a busy schedule to learn something new, and I hope to see you again for the next episode. Take care and see you soon. Bye-bye.